There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. ...2020 marks the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, giving American women the right to vote. In the century since, museum collections haven't kept pace. Not even close. Last fall, the Baltimore Museum of Art announced a bold initiative to help tackle this historic imbalance. Only 4% of the 95,000 artworks in the museum's permanent collection were created by women. Throughout this year, every artwork the museum purchases for its permanent collection will have been created by a woman artist. We recently traveled to Baltimore to see how it's going so far and to chat with museum director Christopher Bedford. Well, thank you for taking some time to talk with us. I guess I wanted to begin with looking at this effort you're making in changing the collection and acquiring more women artists in the collection. This got a lot of buzz over the last several months once the announcement was made. We're now into 2020.
Right.
How is that being implemented? You know, how is it starting?
So I would say museums are pretty glacial in their pace. And one of my convictions is that we need to wind up our metabolism and be slightly more relevant and mainstream in the way that we move. So we have a number of sessions committee meetings throughout the course of the year. So I think one aspect of buying art at a museum that maybe is not well-known publicly and for good reason are the steps that we go through to bring an object into the collection. So first of all, you have a collection roadmap in any area that identifies priorities. Curators are then out in the world looking for those objects. They present them to their fellow curators. If it passes that test, we then take them to our accessions committees. If it passes that test, it goes to the executive committee. If it passes that test, it goes to the full board. So it's an incredibly rigorous, attenuated process. In 2020, you know that in every department across the museum, whether it's African, whether it's American, or whether it's contemporary, every one of the acquisitions has to be female or female identifying. So every curator has their charge. We have two accessions committee meetings per department per year, and everybody's mandate is to present one, two, three, four really significant things, irrespective of finances. So I've encouraged them to dream. And if we find something extraordinary that would really supplement the collection, we will go beyond existing funds. We'll engage in independent fundraising to bring them into the collection. So, you know, our intention is to have a very publicly accessible website to microsite, which will report on this whole process and capture every work we bring into the collection throughout the course of the year, and also, and interestingly, every gift. So you might see a real distinction between the things that we're electing to buy and those things that people are electing to give.
So the previous acquisition budget was around $500,000 a year, or less than $500,000 a year.
Yeah.
And the effort this year is to spend around $2 million or so.
I would
on
say we
acquisitions.
Should, if with no additional fundraising, we would spend about 2.5.
2.5 million.
Yes, but I would, again, I would say if there is a particularly desirable object, let's say within European painting and sculpture, or within the American department, and our acquisition budgets won't permit us to go after it, I'm very committed to raising additional monies.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the gifts. Of course, that $2.5 million does not account for, you know, people making gifts.
Yeah, that's correct.
Do you have any sense of a number of objects that you would like to acquire? Does that factor into it?
No.
Is it more about the quality?
Absolutely. It's much more about the quality. I would far prefer to see fewer objects of high quality, presentation worthy, than I would, you know, panoply of things that we may or may not show. So it's not about sort of gratuitous buying for volume. I think it's about adjusting the texture and quality of our collection by being really determined in big acquisitions.
Yeah.
So you've been here since 2016 now.
Correct.
When you came, there was a lot of buzz about, you know, I think just to be candid, your youth, you know, a lot of energy you were bringing to the job. You know, there were words thrown around like superstar and wunderkind and all kinds of different things. And it seems like this past 6-8 months with some of these efforts have really brought to bear some of that conversation in terms of, you know, doing innovative things and all these things. But it seems like a lot of things have been going on between then to get to now. So when did you start having conversations about making the decision to pursue this collecting effort?
Women artists alone in 2020, probably about 18 to 12 months before the announcement. And I will say it is enormous credit to the Board of Trustees. This is, I think, an unbelievably important point. And I was just speaking with another museum trustee group about exactly this. I think the biggest transformation we've been able to effect at the museum is a transformation in atmosphere on the board. So it is true that when I arrived, we wound things up really, really quickly, made a lot of enormous exhibition and acquisition-based decisions. We went through a total restaffing. We went through a revisioning of the museum, et cetera, and so forth. But now the kind of vision we have for ourselves has been fully codified, socialized, and adopted. The board is now driving it in part themselves. So when we were looking at 2020, they said, well, if artists of color have become your emphasis at the museum and you've been able to achieve success in that by exercising that principle in all categories of behavior at the museum, shouldn't we do the same thing with women? Shouldn't it be an incredibly ambitious program? So 23 shows. Shouldn't we only buy works by women? Shouldn't we only have public programs featuring women artists and women intellectuals? Shouldn't we make this a totalizing effort and really connect our identity now with the way that we were formed? And this is a museum formed entirely by women.
That's an interesting point. I do want to touch on that.
Yeah.
So the museum does have a pretty pioneering history in terms of women leadership.
Yeah.
Your predecessor ran the museum for 18 years. And 4% or so is the amount of representation by women artists in the collection prior to this effort. With women at the helm of the museum for such a long time, why wasn't there a bigger focus? You know, there seems a little bit of a disconnect as to, you know, why that didn't become something early on. Do you have any thoughts?
It's a really, really interesting provocation and a question that's possibly unanswerable.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating that the first director of this museum was a woman. Certainly, in my view, the most significant director of the museum was Adeline Breeskin. So she was the commissioner for the 1960 Venice Biennale, which focused on American abstract expressionism, all men. But at the same time, she brought the Cohn Sisters collection to the museum in 1949, that director, Adeline Breeskin. And so it was the vision of those two women and their desire to give a world-class collection to this museum that I think transformed us from being great to an international destination in sort of a nanosecond. So it was, I think it was the pioneering spirit of the director and the pioneering spirit of the two collectors that converged to produce this extraordinary moment that I think we continue to live with as an institution and try and measure ourselves against. You know, are we doing things in the present that will adjust the DNA of this museum to the extent that those Cohen sisters did?
Yeah.
I think that's a question I ask myself again and again. Sue Cohen is a former board chair, now deceased, who led the charge to make the museum free. Doreen Bolger, my predecessor, 18 years. Our current board chair, Claire Zamosky-Siegel, was one of the people who led the charge to make 2020 all that it's becoming. So we're really built by women leaders. And I think the effort in 2020 is to develop some symmetry between the way that we were built and the exhibitions and acquisitions that are the consequence of that work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 4%.
Yeah.
Even with this year-long effort and the amount of money you're putting into it, what number can you possibly get to? With,
yeah.
You know, is it 8%? Is it 10%? 50 would be, I guess, in some ways the ideal, but there's no way you're going to get to 50 in 1 year. You know, do you have any sense of goal, I guess? In that
yeah, area? So I would say there's a slightly different way of thinking about that, which would be to say, firstly, 4% of our collection doesn't really depart from industry standard in any considerable way, unfortunately. So if you look at the Met, I believe the Met is 2%. So at 4, you know, we're doing fractionally better.
Double but, what the Met is.
Yeah, but my line is always that there is no way to use merit to account for that radical distortion in numbers. I mean, 96% versus 4. There is absolutely no way that a merit-based system would yield those numbers. So I think we have to, first of all, confront and acknowledge the fact that bias conscious or not, has structured our entire collecting practices historically. I think for me, the greater variousness that you're able to achieve within a museum, the greater you are and the more relevant you are. I think, you know, brain science tells us this, study of physics tells us this, management tells you this. The more diversity you have in any room, the more complex and more compelling the ideas that emerge. So I apply the same logic to a museum. And in terms of your number question, what I would say is, you're absolutely right. We can't make a substantial impact on 4%. But by buying very expensive presentation quality work in different categories of collecting at the museum, we can change what we're showing. So that's significant. So I don't think we can radically impact the numbers, but I think we can call attention to the problem. I think we can create a reverberating effect in the field. And I think we can, through buying extraordinary work to show, we can change the percentages of what's on view. Now that's very meaningful.
So on January 1st, 2021,
yeah.
Looking back, what's the metric to know whether this was a success or not?
Well, I think it's that immeasurable thing, that atmosphere within the institution that you achieve on a constant pulsing basis throughout the year. That's one
even
thing.
Like some kind of intangible, like you
yeah,
feel
that thing
it
when
you
know. When you know, and I definitely know that yeah. when it happens. There's also the issue of sheer visitation. So are these 23 exhibitions driving sheer numbers? And are those people coming through the door properly diverse? I think that's the critical response issue. I think is enormously important. And then lastly, after the year is over, understanding that this effort never ends, I would love to imagine a world in which those permanent collection galleries are reinstalled with things that we buy through the year to create a very different story in those spaces that's more equitable by gender. And I think that's viable. I don't think we can substantially adjust the collections percentages, but we can adjust the galleries percentages. That would be success.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by that kind of creepy guy who's just a little bit too into that one portrait. You visit every day. And don't get us wrong, that's a good thing. We want regulars here. But hey, buddy, there's a lot more to see, more portraits even. Look around. Maybe make some new friends. However, that being said, if that portrait starts talking back to you, please let us know. That would make for some killer social media content.
Beyond gender inequity, which you're taking head on and trying to address here, will you be kind of taking on new initiatives to focus on other areas of the collection where there's underrepresentation?
Mm-hmm.
And how will you do that? Is there a broader plan for the collection writ large in terms of these gaps that need to be filled?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have made, since over the last 3 years, we've made artists of color and their defining impact, particularly in the 20th century, the leading edge of this museum. So that will remain so. So even within 2020, and within the focus on women, there is an increased focus on women of color. That will continue. I think the great and interesting challenge for me is trying to apply those principles to historical areas of collecting. So it's relatively easy in the post-war period to identify those artists who have been written out of history and write them back in. And we have a huge and very adept contemporary department, very integrated, very little overlap in expertise. And those people out in the world doing that work, and I'm extremely confident in it. And it's not to say that it's easy, it isn't. We're just very well staffed in that area, and the project is a little more straightforward. What I would really love to see is curators in the Department of African Art, Asian Art, American Art traditionally defined, and European Painting and Sculpture, taking those principles of vision and applying them to their area of historical study and trying to unearth either those subjects or those producers that haven't been a part of dominant history and writing them in. So the looking back part has become much more interesting to me than doing the work in the present, which I think we've been doing successfully, and I've been doing successfully for a long time. It's pretty straightforward. There's a more complex project to be done, and I think it has to do with the Encyclopedic Museum.
How long does it take for a director to start to have an imprint on the institution? These things are ocean liners and they take a long time to start changing things. And every director has their own personality and their own interest, and there's certainly a stamp of some kind that comes. Are you starting to feel that you're able to do that? Meaning, not just in terms of exhibition, the process of creating and implementing exhibitions, a lot of things were probably already in the pipeline when you started, and those transitions take time.
Right.
Does it feel more and more as if it's kind of adhering to a certain vision that you
had when you started
here? Oh, absolutely so.
Yeah, and I would say it's really interesting you asked that question now. I think that I've started to feel that much more forcefully in the last couple of months. So, for instance, the last all-staff meeting, I presented much less. It was really the curators that led the charge along with our senior staff. And it was really interesting to sit back and look and understand that every area is now sort of running wild in pursuit of these ideas. And it doesn't take much oversight or management to achieve that. And it does feel that it's a museum with a different culture and vision that has definitely taken root. Now, I think to make that sustainable and permanent is a different proposition. I think you have to keep pushing, keep thinking, and never take that culture shift for granted. But in terms of how long it actually takes, I mean, I'm sort of a proponent of the idea that no director should be in a position for more than about 10 years. I think that there's virtue in the new, no matter what.
Well, it seems like the industry is starting to agree with you because, you see a lot of people who maybe were 25, 30-year directors back in late 1900s.
Yeah.
You know, that mid-century model has waned somewhat, and it doesn't seem like you're going to see that in the future.
I agree with you completely, and I think that, you know, corporate America, for all of its problems, does teach you what innovation looks like. And corporations tend to be pretty relentless in renewing their leadership, and I don't think it has to do with a person going out doing a bad job. It's the change itself and the new itself is inherently virtuous and advantageous. So I do believe in that principle.
Well, you know, having said that, you think that, you know, there may be some kind of decade limit on how long someone should have that impact on an organization. That comes with the idea that there's a ticking clock in terms of kind of what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, building, you know, you talk about this contemporary project where you're building on a new wing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there kind of a bucket list of things that you want to achieve while you're here?
I'm
sure some of them are not public yet, but in terms of what's been shared and what's out there.
Well, I'll give you one really good example that I think relates to your point about applying this vision across different collecting areas or different areas of scholarly pursuit. So we are dedicating in the fall of 2021 the Center for Matisse Studies at the museum, and it was a consequence of the extraordinary generosity of a local foundation that provided the money for both the physical establishment of the center and the endowment to support the production of scholarship. So the big question for me becomes, how then do you take Matisse, an iconic artist of the 20th century, in many people's view, the most important painter of the 20th century, somebody whose formal influence continues to reverberate, somebody whose reputation completely changed our reputation as a museum, and then apply the values of the present and say, well, how was Matisse interacting with the art of Africa? What was the relationship between Kuba textiles or African textiles and his interest in pattern? How did he interact with non-Western cultures? What was the sort of nature of his transaction? And how can we produce exhibitions and publications that unpack and interrogate those questions? So to me, that necessarily enfolds new scholarship, younger people, people from across the diaspora, who are interested in Matisse and love his work, but have perhaps a different investment in understanding him. So that to me is extraordinarily exciting. And if that center can begin to produce a different kind of scholarship around the 20th century's most important painter, again, I just think that that's wildly exciting.
The reception to the collection initiative was widely hailed as a great idea. There was some pushback in some circles, some discussion of the focus being too narrow or too specific to gender in a time where we're kind of thinking differently about gender fluidity. Did any of that hit home in any real way or make you rethink everything, or have you been kind of solidly on board with the whole idea from the get-go?
Well, I think one thing we're really blessed with is a roster of curators who are intellectual agitators, which is really, you know, really, really nice. And of our 23 curators, I think 21 are women. So there's no shortage of pressure being placed on the idea of female and female identifying. Now, you could say that the whole concept of fluidity in gender is an aspect of the present. You could also say that that fluidity has always been present, and we just now have words for it. And so then to look back and try to find those moments in history is incredibly compelling. And additionally, to look at the present moment, and sure, that put pressure on the idea of female artist. You know, what can that mean in the hands of various different practitioners? So I think the whole principle of putting a structure like that in place presupposes that people push back against it. And I think that's the role of our curators, particularly, you know, we've gone through a pretty radical restaffing in that area. So I feel confident they will challenge me and the idea and the public.
One of the things that a director can bring to the table the most, more than anything, is a tone and voice of an institution.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And has there been a moment, whether it's a day or you're taking a break and stepping out of your office and walking down to the galleries and you see something, some moment, and it could be a private thing, it doesn't have to be a public moment, where you thought, this is working, or you feel proud about what you're doing, something that just felt like some kind of critical mass had been achieved? Has there been a moment like that?
Yeah, I mean, even just this morning, I was touring somebody through one of the spaces that we're renovating for the creation of the Matisse Center, and happened to go upstairs to come back to my office. And we're rotating the contemporary wing, and it will be home to, I believe, four monographic presentations of work by women artists, ranging from Valerie Maynard, who is an 85-year-old African-American woman working across media, has an amazing history, and is now based in Baltimore. And then an installation by the Berlin-based painter, installation artist Katerina Grosser. So when I walked up, I saw an assembly of sort of five contemporary curators, all doing the work very independent of any oversight. I realized that I'd completely forgotten about the timeline for the installation of the wing, and the progress was sort of startling. And they were so clearly passionate at the helm, I thought, that felt very good.
Yeah. Kind of as if you can, you know, the message has gotten through, people are kind of taking it to heart. You're not having to kind of reiterate the message over and over again.
I think I want the curators at the museum, and actually everybody, to feel a total creative liberty and feel that mistakes are fine, that failure is often part of the principle that we're pursuing, and that if they weren't pushing hard with the possibility of achieving maybe something slightly beyond their reach, then they would not actually be meeting the mandate that we've laid forth. So, and I hope everybody feels that liberty to push themselves and possibly fail in the pursuit of something better. And I do think that that probably is a tone that's established by museum leadership, where people feel sort of protected and able to explore. And that's exciting.
Museums still in many ways have a hierarchical structure that is in some ways old-fashioned compared to the way a lot of corporate structures are
our
businesses. A lot of that plays into generational politics. You're kind of low-end Gen X, but not too far past you know, old millennials on your age. So you're bringing something generationally to the museum that's just different than anything that's happened before.
Yeah.
Do you see the structure of an organization in terms of access and how people interact and the staff, and you don't have to go through 15 layers to get to one person. Do you think you see that differently just because of the generation you came up in, the world you live in today, how you see the way businesses are structured, organizations, nonprofits, all of that, how that all works?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't like hierarchies very much. I certainly don't like the idea that a decision needs to be fed up through 14 different channels to eventually reach one person who then slightly adjusts that decision that goes all the way back down the ladder again. It just strikes me as inefficient and also not very creative. So the way that we try to organize here is by teams as opposed to by sort of vertical lines. So teams will assemble around a project. My feeling is you gather those people in the room, and whoever has the sort of best idea prevails in the space.
A meritocracy.
So
the idea wins.
Right. So it's not, if it's a curatorial assistant, if it's a designer, if it's the chief curator, if it's the director, it doesn't matter. As long as it contributes to making the thing better. Yeah.
And is that something that you feel is happening now?
Absolutely. And is pretty explicit, the expectation that we gather together around things, work on them, work them into a form that we all find compelling. And there's kind of a collective authorship. So, for instance, with 2020 Vision as the moniker for 2020, I believe, though I'm not sure, that Melanie Martin, who is our chief innovation officer, came up with that. But I'm not sure. I think it's very collectively owned. And so with sort of when the brand appears and when the name is reiterated, I think everybody feels that it's theirs.
Yeah. You probably take a million people on tours. You're always taking donors or guests or anyone, media.
Yeah.
What's the first or couple of things that you always show someone when they're visiting?
So there's a moment where you can see the cone collection along with this amazing...
Can you talk about the cone collection just briefly?
Oh, certainly. So the cone collection is formed by the Cone Sisters of Baltimore. They took their lead from Gertrude Stein in the early years of the 20th century and began exploring the European, particularly French avant-garde, formed an absolutely superb, possibly unsurpassed collection. One of the two sisters died in 1929. The other persisted for another 20 years, and in that 20-year period, deepened her relationship with Matisse very substantially. And in the process, developed the greatest account of his work in the world media in any collection anywhere in the world.
Which speaks to this other initiative we were talking about this.
Correct. So how do you drag the extraordinary radical decision that those sisters made, because it's so far beyond anything we're doing at the moment. To invest in that work at that point was unprecedented. How do you drag its relevance into the present and sort of recapture them and what they would have done?
It's not, you know, an amber just preserved in the past. It's a real living thing.
Sort of what would the Coen sisters do now?
Yeah.
And I'm fairly sure that they would not be stayed in their activities. Yeah. They just wouldn't. So there's a moment where you can see the Blue Nude, which is one of the iconic paintings in the collection. And I want to say the date is 1906. Could that be correct? Maybe. Iconic painting in the collection. And you, in a glance, you can see that. And Wangechi Mutu's first cast bronze sculpture, which is called Water Woman, but it's a mermaid. And she's an amazing artist. She's of African descent, living and working in Brooklyn. She's the first artist to receive the commission for the Met facade, which is now populated with these amazing bronzes. But the first bronze she ever made was this mermaid. And it now sits in the center of the contemporary rotunda. You can see that and the Blue Nude in a single glance. And it's become, since we've had it on permanent view, the most popular object in the museum. So I think that shows you...
Those two pieces in conversation mm-hmm. represent kind of the past, the future, and where you want to be.
Right? And I think our values right now.
In the middle of the 19th century, French artist Rosa Bonheur acquired a license to dress as a man. Civil codes were established under Napoleon in 1804, but the law pertaining to clothing defined by gender was enacted a few years earlier, on November 7th, 1800. Trousers, Bonheur asserted, were a practical garment for a painter and absolutely required on certain occasions. Quote, I was forced to recognize that the clothing of my sex was a constant bother. That is why I decided to solicit the authorization to wear men's clothing from the prefect of police. End quote. She wore what she wanted. She lived how she wanted. Opinions be damned. She once said, "The epithets of imbeciles have never bothered me." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.